Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, a classic and fine talk by Gore Vidal. He spoke in 1982, and he's talking about us today. I hope you'll stay tuned. Again, I confess, New World Notes has never given novelist, essayist, and political commentator Gore Vidal the airtime he deserves. We continue to make amends today. Vidal's persona is witty, elegant, cultured, and informed by much study of American history. Despite his patrician upbringing, his politics were remarkably progressive. He is now most sincerely dead. Even so, his words have much to speak to us today. And no, the Trump presidency did not change everything. In fact, it did not change anything fundamental. In his talk today, Vidal discusses some of his key ideas. The U.S. has become a garrison state whose main business is war. The U.S. military wages constant, aggressive, smallish wars against Third World nations, primarily to keep the military-industrial congressional complex and Wall Street rich and prosperous. Furthermore, the United States really has only one political party. The policy differences between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are too small to worry about, thinks Vidal. Both parties specialize in distracting and diverting the people from the constant war, economic injustice, and other real problems. Today we will hear Vidal speaking during the time of Ronald Reagan. He would hardly have to change a word if he were speaking during the time of Obama or Trump. He spoke to an organization of business people in San Francisco on January 28, 1982. This was a few years before the collapse of the Soviet Union, and it was well before 9/11, the Iraq War, and the latest collapse of the financial system, none of which changed anything. Here, in top form, is Gore Vidal.
So I will give you my State of the Union. I've got a couple of notions about war and taxes, the only two things of huge urgency facing us. First of all, there is something I think very wrong with the United States of America today, and there has been something very wrong for quite some time. We have a one-party system that is the creation of those great financial interests that have controlled our country off and on, but mostly on, since 1786. Our single-party system is currently divided into two factions. One is called Republican and the other is called Democrat. This division is supposed to give us a sense of choice at election time, sort of on the order of painkiller X is better than painkiller Y, but each is aspirin. So in the absence of political parties, it is not surprising that we have no politics at the national level, as opposed to elections, where those who do vote provide a sort of Greek chorus to a drama over which they have no control. As a result of this absence of real politics, half of those qualified to vote never vote at all. And there are now signs that those who do vote are beginning to realize that it makes no difference on the national level who wins any election, because taxes and inflation will continue to increase as our real income decreases. And though the budget for the Pentagon will always expand in response to whatever enemy the enemy of the month club has sent us, We can be sure that the poor will get poorer, the rich will get richer, and the middle class, which is the country, will continue to carry the better part of the tax burden. You know, today for middle-income people, they pay 26 cents on every dollar goes to government. Corporations, particularly the top 500, according to Fortune, now pay no tax at all on vast earnings. As we approach this year's elections, our single-party candidates are now telling us that we need to give the Pentagon even more money because the Soviet Union has outstripped us militarily. This is not true, of course, but it sounds alarming, particularly when we are told that the Soviets will come flying through the vulnerability window. Give Reagan credit for an occasional burst of candor. When he was interviewed by Dan Rather, he said the Russians are ahead of us. There's this vulnerability window thing. And he started to laugh. I don't know whether it had not been explained to him what it meant. But it sounded funny to him. Because of the Soviet Union, Reagan wants to give the Pentagon $1,500,000,000 over the next 5 years. And yet, no matter how much money we spend on defense, it is never enough. Why is this? No professional politician is going to answer that question, because if he did, he would lose his professional status. The best that he can do is remind us that life is worse in the Soviet Union than it is here. This is quite true, but so what? What is that to do with the fact that schools are being shut down, that 50,000 businesses went bankrupt last year, the city streets are a battleground, and unemployment, the actual rate, is about 11 million people? The professional politician has no answer to any of these problems, partly because he is, by definition, a part of the problem. Press him too hard and he will tell us, in the immortal words of Spiro Agnew, that the United States, for all its faults, is still the greatest nation in the country. I am rather taken by history, so I like to put things in historical context, which is sometimes wearisome, but I date the beginning of our problems to the year 1847, when The City and the Pillar was published. When the United States attacked Mexico in order to seize a great deal of land. And the young Ulysses S. Grant, who was just out of West Point, fought in that war. At the end of his life, Grant, who wrote one of the great memoirs of all time, he's one of our best prose writers, if worse presidents, he said of our theft of Mexico's land, "To us, it was an empire of incalculable value, but it might have been obtained by other means. The Civil War was largely the outgrowth of the Mexican War. Nations, like individuals, are punished for their transgressions. We got our punishment in the most sanguinary and expensive war of modern times." Well, I tend to accept Grant's somewhat metaphysical view that there is a rude justice in human affairs. As the Civil War was a judgment on the United States for what we did to Mexico, so the unraveling of the American polity in the last 30 years has been the result of our unremitting hostility, open or covert, to practically every nation on earth. Our rulers have tried to make this nation the military master of the world. Why? Because war has been the business of the United States for almost half a century. Why? Because it is through war or its threat that those who control the economic life of the country can make maximum profits
and the door of the Treasury is always open to them. I know that the past is literally a closed book for most of our countrymen. After all, if we understood our own past, not to mention the history of our race, we would not allow ourselves to be so misgoverned and exploited by our rulers. But the schools belong to them, not to mention the media, and so we are obliged to live in a constant, anxious present, threatened on every side by enemies that are very often totally imaginary. You know, for those of you under 45, the fact that the United States is a nation forever at war, hot or cold, is a fact of life. You have never known anything different. It is now 40 years since the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor. Since then, we have fought bloody wars in Korea and Southeast Asia and cold wars in every other continent. Now, Ronald Reagan, in the bright springtime of his senescence, is arranging, if not the next world war, something pretty hot, perhaps in Nicaragua or El Salvador. It doesn't much matter where, because as Reagan's self-styled vicar on earth, Alexander the Great Haig, has said, this was unbelievable, apropos Argentina, why we were supporting them. He said, we'll support any regime, no matter how dictatorial, that believes in one God. Well, it's at least a twist on our usual line about freedom and democracy. We now want to make the world safe for monotheism. The notion that war is good for business took hold in the wake of the Depression. In the late 1920s, our financial institutions collapsed. Although the country was as rich as it had ever been, and a lot richer than it is today, there was huge unemployment and financial chaos. The government was powerless to do anything but serve the great interests, and they were cutting their losses. And there was 25% unemployment. In the 30s, the New Deal pushed the country toward a sort of welfare state, and the Depression lessened. But it had not ended when the Second War began. During the war years, we had full employment for the first time in decades, while an entire generation was helped by the armed services, who fed and clothed and housed them better than many of them had ever known before. Those of us who served in the Second War assumed that when we got out of the military, we would be looked after by a grateful nation, and so we were. Unlike the victims of more recent wars, we had the GI Bill of Rights. We also assumed, and here comes the crux and the beginning of our great problems, we assumed that the war industries would shift over to peacetime manufacture. There were a lot of things to be done internally. We needed new railroad systems, mass transit, slums to be repaired. There was a great deal to be done internally. Externally, we were the most powerful nation in the world. From 1945 to 1950, we alone had the atomic bomb. Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union had been pretty much knocked out by the war. So if ever a nation was on top of the world, it was us in 45. Our rulers were then faced with a choice. Either we could repair and perfect our own country and be what we were intended to be, a great commercial power in the world, or we could continue to maintain a large military force for which arms must be made in order that we might be the world's military master or policeman, which was the word we used to use in that innocent time. The financial interests made their choice. We would be the world's policemen. We would fight communism day and night until we had defeated this terrible disease. I was speaking the other night in Irvine, And the lady got up and she said, I have two questions. One, what can I, as an average housewife, do to fight communism? The second, Mr. Vidal, what is communism? Well, the Greeks have a word for what we did and are doing, and you know the word is hubris. We had and we have neither the intelligence nor the wealth to govern the world. But once the decision was made to turn the country into a garrison state, it was necessary for the politicians and the media to convince the people that we were in such mortal danger that the Treasury must give the Pentagon a blank check. So the Soviet Union, which had barely survived the war, was suddenly turned into a huge monolithic octopus with tentacles everywhere on Earth. It must be said that a good job was done and the Cold War was off to a flying start. We had given tacit approval at Yalta to the Soviet Union that they had the hegemony of Eastern Europe, and they responded by shoring up their ramshackle empire, and they strangled all resistance in Hungary, East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia. Then they acquired atomic weapons. Meanwhile, we had discovered a brand new enemy, China. The yellow peril of the last century had suddenly turned red on us. So to contain China, we fought in Korea. To contain China, we fought in Southeast Asia. But the Vietnam War took such a long time that even before the war had ended, the attention span of our rulers had snapped. Suddenly, my favorite American politician, Richard Nixon, wandered off to Peking. And nobody quite knows why, but there suddenly he was. And he met Mao Tse-tung, who turned out to be a pretty good American after all, as your average red Chinese goes. But as Nixon said, 1 billion Chinese drink a lot of Pepsi Cola. This, of course, is true, but a lot of us knew that all along. In 1960, I was the only congressional candidate in the country to advocate the admission of Red China to the UN. Better trade than war, I said. But I didn't realize then, we were all pretty innocent, that a garrison state must fight an occasional war in order to convince the long-suffering taxpayer that his money is well spent. After Nixon's trip to Peking, the Vietnam War made no sense at all. But we must give them our friends credit for a sense of humor. We are in Vietnam and Cambodia, they told us with an absolutely straight face, in order to save those Southeast Asians who love freedom and democracy from those North Southeast Asians who hate freedom and democracy. So finally, the long, bloody, expensive war was fought for no reason at all, except to give taxpayers money to the real enemy, our military, industrial, political complex. The war was a fraud, except for those who died or were wounded. And for them, it was and it is a tragedy of obscene proportions. Now, Mr. Reagan and the Bel Air Crusaders decided that a war just about anywhere is a necessity. One lucky thing, perhaps, for us is they're pretty vague about history and geography. They don't much care whether the war is in Nicaragua or Angola or Pakistan. All they know is that war is good for the business of the sort of business people who have been financing Mr. Reagan for the last 17 years. The entire AWAC deal was simply an $8.5 billion giveaway to Boeing. It had nothing of any political importance. Also, with wartime powers, you can silence your critics, you can lock up dissenters, you can empty the treasury, all in the name of freedom. Luckily, a few months ago, when Haig tried on El Salvador for size, he found that Congress and the media were not very enthusiastic. So the question now being asked at the White House is, If the next war can't be a small, manageable one, are we ready for the big time? Can we fight and win a limited, unlimited, non-nuclear, nuclear war to show the whole world that we are still whatever it is we're supposed to be? All eyes are now in the Middle East. We lost the Shah. Then we lost Iran, which, if you remember, George Washington specifically left us in his will. Now we've lost Sadat. Will we lose Egypt? Will we lose the oil fields? Well, thanks to the clumsiness and mismanagement, we do indeed have real problems in the Middle East, which do affect, or could affect, our security and well-being. But I must say, just to follow the muddled way that the administration has gone about preparing for this war, before the election, Reagan came up with the following scenario. Since the Soviet Union is running out of oil and natural gas, they will take advantage of the mess in Iran and seize all the Arab oil fields. To the election, Mr. Reagan asked the CIA for a report on Soviet resources, and the CIA, bless their black hearts, sent back word that the Soviet Union has enough oil for the rest of the century and more natural gas than they know what to do with. Outraged, the White House sent the report back for a rewrite. Second version was pretty much like the first. That's Warner Brothers. Finally, the new chief of the CIA told the White House what they wanted to hear. A collapsing Soviet Union, desperate for oil, will soon be on the march. And so, once again, the United States, the Clark Kent of freedom, must go back into that telephone booth. This would all be genuinely funny if it weren't so dangerous. Last year in L.A. during the campaign, George Bush assured us that we could survive pretty easily a nuclear war. I don't know if you saw it last week, the administration told us that we've got to prepare civil defense, that we could not only we could survive very well, we have to go out and dig lots of trenches, fairly deep, and put boards over them and a lot of earth, about 2 feet of earth, and twigs over that. Then after the nuclear explosion, we can come out in a few days and we can recognize each other at night because we'll be shining. And when somebody pointed out to him, but what's there to come back to? I mean, everything's polluted and there won't be any cities. They'll all be knocked down. He said, you know, whenever you kick over an ant hill, the ants always rebuild it. I suppose this is the Reagan plan for urban renewal. 2 out of 3 Americans have now been psyched into thinking that war is inevitable. As Reagan said last year, the Soviet Union underlies all the unrest that's going on. If they weren't engaged in those games of dominoes, there wouldn't be any hot spots in the world. Well, if he really believes this, he's a lot simpler than one suspects. If he does not believe it, then he is dangerous to us all. What is now plain is that if we continue to waste upon the military the $1.5 trillion they are to get over the next 5 years, we'll be faced with one of two things: a nuclear war and the end of the road for this particular civilization, or the bankruptcy of the United States. There is no third alternative. When I got out of the Army 35 years ago, if somebody had said to me our troops would still be in Europe in 1981, I would have laughed. It was a crazy notion. But they're still there with ground troops that are not meant to fight because they're too ill-trained, not to mention outnumbered. They are hostages to our allies to make sure that should our troops be endangered, we would strike back at the Soviet. Well, Western Europe is now much richer and more populous than we are. Since many Europeans don't want us there at all, and those who do want us there don't want to help us pay the bills, and it's currently $83 billion a year for NATO, I would say let them look after their own defense, at least on the ground. Let us bring home the troops. Certainly, we should maintain air and naval bases in the area if they want us to. If they don't, Well, we can use the $83 billion here at home. That will just about cover the official deficit. At the moment, 60% of the Pentagon budget goes for the defense of Japan, Korea, and Western Europe. I think a lot of this can and should be paid for by those prosperous nations. And if this were done, we could easily and safely cut the military budget for 1983 by 25%. To defend the United States, we need well-trained and well-paid technicians whose task is to provide the country with a defense so total as to discourage an attack from anywhere. The maintenance of a large land army is pointless unless you are planning to make wars of aggression on weaker nations, let's say in Latin America. And if you want to do that, you will have to reinstitute the draft. And if you reinstitute the draft in what, despite the best efforts of our governors, is still peacetime, you will have a rebellion. Because the very notion of a peacetime draft runs contrary to everything the United States is supposed to represent. Unfortunately, our rulers are becoming increasingly more arrogant and totalitarian-minded. They would like to control all our lives totally. To this end, they would like to draft the young, which in peacetime is simply enslavement. They harass the middle class with the IRS, an extortion racket that could have taught the Gestapo a trick or two. They keep tabs on millions and millions of us through thousands and thousands of spies in the CIA, FBI, DIA, DEA. You know, we have more spies spying on Americans within the United States than the Soviet Union has spying on their people. This is intolerable. You know, to be blunt about it, in a sense, we are an occupied nation, and it will take great effort, perseverance, and education to free ourselves peacefully from those who have taken charge of the garrison state that we have become.
And here we must pause. Gore Vidal's talk in San Francisco, January 28, 1982. The audio is courtesy of a radio program, The Gay Life, on San Francisco's station KFAN. Many thanks to them. We'll hear more of this fine talk at a later date. On the web, you can hear more of us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. You'll find our podcasts there and also on radioforall.net. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, reminding you that you are not alone, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.